This is the Radio Walensky Podcast. I'm Richard Walensky with new and archive interviews from the Probabilities and Bookwaves Art Waves programs on KPFA-FM and Pacifica Syndication. My guest is Ayodele Nzinga, who is the Poet Laureate of Oakland. She is also the director of a play, Pac and Biggie Are Dead, by Biko Iason Martin. It originally played in Philadelphia. It's playing at what used to be the Flight Deck and Piano Fight Oakland, which is now BAM House, B-A-M House, and that's through June 30th. And for more information on the play, you can go to Lower Bottom Playaz, PLAYAZ.com. Ayodele Nzinga is also a writer, poet, has a book of poetry, Incandescent. There's an indie film that you were in called E14, which is currently streaming on Prime. And what is your role with BAMBD Fest? Are you the director?
I am the creator. BAM Fest is a biennial international arts festival that is hosted by BAM CDC. I am the executive director of BAM CDC. BAM and BAMD are both acronyms. BAMD, Black Arts Movement Business District. That's the cultural district in Oakland.
Before we get into the play, I would like to talk a little about Lower Bottom Playaz. It's had several different homes before finally settling at BAM House.
We were a gypsy company up until 1999 when I met Washington Burns, who was the director of the Prescott Center at 920 Peralta in Oakland. And he built me a theater, the Sister Thea Bowman Memorial Theater. It was a regulation-sized theater in the backyard of a community center that was housed inside of a Victorian in West Oakland. That theater went dark in 2013. That is the same year that the Flight Deck was reclaiming 1540 Broadway, which had been an abandoned warehouse up until then. They founded Oakland's only 100-seat black box theater there. Ragged Wing, the founding company, went dark in 2019, and by them going dark, they gave up the building. It was taken over by Piano Fight, a group of young men who also had an establishment in San Francisco by the same name. Unfortunately, then the pandemic hit. We stayed in residence there at 1540. We've been in residence at 1540 since 2013. So being the most consistent thing about the place since it had turned into a theater, we decided to take over the lease. And so now we are the BAM House is run by BAM CDC, and the Lower Bottom Playaz are the company in residence there.
So let's go back. You said that in 99 you were a gypsy theater company. What's the origin of Lower Bottom to begin with, going way back?
I'm an actress, and I worked with Marvin X. Marvin has the distinction of having written the longest running black play in North America. It was called In the Name of Love. So I directed that show. I acted in there. I was trained by Nora Vaughn, the founder of the Black Repertory Theater in Berkeley. I founded a troupe because I had started writing. I started writing because there weren't enough roles for black women. I wanted to do roles with more texture, more nuanced roles. So I decided to write them. That's the thing about me. If something I want doesn't exist, then I create it. So having created material and assembled a bunch of actors who liked working with me, we would do juvenile hall, we would do churches, we would do parks, we would perform wherever we could, homeless centers, every place. It was exciting, and it was excellent, excellent experience. And I sort of modeled it off of my apprenticeship with Marvin X, which is a tutelage under fire, you know, non-traditional places, non-traditional artists, non-traditional audiences. So a longing for permanence had me found the Lower Bottom Playaz.
Do you remember the year that the Playaz actually came into existence?
Probably more like 1995, 1994.
And along the way, after you began working in a semi-permanent place before you actually took it over, that's when you did the 10 August Wilson plays in sequence. Is that correct?
We started the August Wilson Century Cycle at the Prescott Center in the Thea Bowman Memorial Theater. The last one we did there was 7 guitars. And my current angel at the time, Dr. Washington Burns, may his memory be a blessing, came to me and said, West Oakland was gentrifying at that point in time. And we had a new board that had new priorities. And theater wasn't at the top of their list of priorities. And so he asked me if I could take a pause in the production of the Century Cycle. And that was non-negotiable. So I gave the residency back. We did Fences at the Oakland African American Museum. The set was an installation. We lined up people around the block on Thanksgiving Day. And from the African American Museum, we moved into 1540 Broadway. And we've been there ever since. And that's where we finished the Century Cycle.
I've seen around half, I think, of the 10 plays. Which do you think resonates most with you?
I really don't have a favorite. I'm very enamored of Jim of the Ocean. It sort of is the foundational piece, although that's the piece that Wilson wrote last. And I think that maybe he needed to write the others to understand for himself where the North Star for the work was. Every time I'm producing one, that is my favorite one. In the moment, they're all terribly, terribly rich. It's an interwoven tale. When I got to the end, Radio Golf, which I've actually done, I did Radio Golf again last year. I did Radio Golf and Joe Turner's Come and Gone again last year for our 24th season. We're in our 25th season now. And at the time, they were both my favorite. Wilson's very important to me as a theater maker. I have the distinction of being the only director to have ever done them in chronological order. Of course, there are directors who've done them all, and most of those had the privilege of working with the master when he was alive. I like to tell people I fell in love with him after he died, and that doesn't make our love affair any less real. So he was pivotal in my life as an actress and also a director and a writer. I began to have the language for things I intuitively knew, understood, leaned to in my taste for direction and selection for material. And I didn't really have a place where they came from. And you know, everything comes from somewhere. There is nothing new. When I met Wilson, it was like meeting a teacher.
Ayodele and Zynga, let's get into the new play. How has your work on the Wilson plays, how has that informed your direction of Pock and Biggie Are Dead?
Well, one of the biggest things is Wilson gave me permission and encouraged me to make Black life the centerpiece, not the margin, the reason for the tale, for the logic to come from that center. And this is a very Black story, even though it also has elements of European theater in it. Molière makes an appearance in Pock and Biggie. Shakespeare makes an appearance in Pock and Biggie. And the author likes to call this work a freestyle on a stopper track.
A takeoff in a way on Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead.
But it still resonates very, very much from a Black lens by the use of these two popular Black icons who are no longer with us, who share their tragic deaths.
In reading the play, it struck me that one of the challenges was in making sure that the audience understood who was coming onto stage. How did you manage that? And take us through the process of making sure the audience would know exactly what was going on.
I think that some of it is because people know their history. And so some of the conversations and the situations you put people in, Booker T. Washington and Du Bois are never explicitly named. But because of the lines and because of their interaction, we understand that this is yet another beef, a beef long before hip hop between two Black icons. Ida Wells walks into their conversation and she's introduced by Booker T, who says, "Ah, damn it, here comes Ida." So sometimes they're names that let people who may be too young to reference some of this historical material can lead them into it. But if you are of an age to have enjoyed Tupac and the Notorious B.I.G. in their prime, then all of that history is accessible to you. It was one of the things I discussed with the playwright right before we put it on. I had the same trepidation. How will we know who all these people are? Oddly, in production, one, there are these really quick costume changes. So people are in near appropriate or memorable costumes. Like Suge Knight makes an appearance in a red bowler hat and a red shirt. Everybody knows that's Suge Knight. Puff Daddy makes an appearance. And you know it's him, not just by the dapper dress, but because he can't stop dancing. So there are a lot of little cultural inside turns that we take. Some of these people are historical. There are a few breadcrumbs. And we ran four shows over the last weekend, and people were able to keep up.
How did you find the play? It played in Philadelphia a couple of years ago. Were you familiar with Biko at the time?
Biko is actually a family friend. I've known Biko and his brother Tongo. Tongo happens to be the poet laureate of San Francisco. Since they were younger, they participated in a performing arts camp that my youth participated in. There's an artistic extended family relationship there. He brought that work through LA and they did something experimental there. And that bought up postings from when he did it at Drexel. And I looked at the clips and it just seemed fascinating. Also, the name was interesting. So I sent for the script. He sent back the script and I decided to do it. It's very much within the mission of what Lower Bottom Players does. We do work from the Black canon and we do the work of emerging writers, new playwrights. So it was our pleasure to give it a full production, a West Coast production. It is still considered to be in development. So the writer is still tinkering with it. But it's very fulsome at this point, and I'm really, really happy that we got a chance to work with it.
A lot of the play moves from the direction of verse and poetry toward hip hop. And at the same time, these are characters and this is a play. What kind of direction can you give the actors to find that balance between the different elements?
It helps if you don't believe so much in genres. Genres are nice ways of separating stuff. It tends in the Black experience that the division into genres does not serve as well as it does in European theater. And I believe that might be a bit of the critique of European theater that's taking place inside the piece, which manages to be about a lot of things and takes a few swipes at European theater along the way. So the division between poetry, verse, and hip-hop lyricism could be considered a very artificial divide. One could say it simply moves between different types of verse and that the entire piece is a poem of sorts in its wholeness.
There's also a lot of political statements made within it, which are almost like, it seems to me, counterpoint to the dialogue between the two of them and commentary on the dialogue. Is that one of the reasons that you were attracted to the play?
It's interesting. Some of the political, I would tell you, is frozen in time and is correct for that circa. The comments about F the police are very much, they're part of the words and the music at that point in time. But at the very same time, those are sentiments that are still shouted. And then when we look at the fact that beef existed all the way back to some of the encounters that Harriet Tubman had with slaves who wouldn't run out of fear, and that Du Bois and Booker T. Washington tended beef way back in their time. So the play at one time points to what was real in the lives of the characters, but then holds this larger narrative for North American Africans. It's about a conversation we've been in, not just encased in the life of Pac and Biggie, but since we arrived in this country, and that conversation continues after the death of Pac and Biggie.
One of the points of the play that I really liked is they were going on and suddenly we get a feminist rebuke. When you were working on that, was that kind of like some of the most fun you had on it?
I like the appearance of Sojourner Truth, who does rebuke, not them specifically, though it might appear that way. It's more a critique of the way Black womanhood is held, I believe, in this country and in the language they were just deploying, and how when one hears that language, instantly it's been normalized through performance. And for a moment, it's okay, you know? And then we have this antebellum character come on and read them for filth is rather beautiful. But it's actually not my favorite part in the play. I would advise everyone to come and see this play for the moment with Molière, which I find just delicious.
Well, that's a little bit later on when the critique of European theater comes in with Molière and Shakespeare, using their words from plays, Shakespeare in particular. There's also a comment I think Biko made in an interview about the relationship of Hamlet to this play, not merely just Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, but Hamlet specifically. Can you go into that a little bit?
I think how it plays out here is the reflection in purgatory, the use of the device of a ghost. And the device in our play is the mothers, the mothers themselves. And he's taken liberty because the mothers aren't dead, but he's turned them into caricatures of, well, not caricatures, that's not the right word, reflections of Hamlet's mother walking through the palace. I also think the yearning for death, suicidal thoughts that are carried inside the soliloquy from Hamlet are very appropriate to what's being discussed inside this particular work. Is it honorable to be ready to die? What does it mean when you say that your only fear of death is reincarnation? So I think that those are things that came out of Pac and Biggie's mouths, ended up in their music, and they're very Shakespearean in nature. And one wonders, did they understand the mirroring of Shakespeare? Or it, again, if something older and more permanent than just a play, just Hamlet or even just Pac and Biggie being considered in this moment, the pain and the weight of life itself weighed against what would it be like to not exist at all.
There's some sequences in the script, and I kept going, you know, this almost feels like it might work as a movie, but it's not a movie.
I might have said something very similar to the playwright as I'm looking at it. I have the experience of being a playwright and being a director and being a producer. All three have a very different approach to theater making. As a producer, one wonders, so you want me to get an airplane? Is that what you're saying? You need an airplane? No, you can't have an airplane. As a director, I'm saying, well, if I don't have an airplane, how are they in an airplane? How do I make this work? So you are right. It would be an excellent movie. It would be an excellent movie where the many changes in place could be more readily accomplished by special effects and fade-ins and fade-outs. But you need to come and see what we have done for this, how we make it work on a stage without any reserve at all. And yes, I'm boasting. The production value of this piece is crazy. We make it work.
I'm glad you brought up the plane, because suddenly they're outside the plane, then they're inside the plane, and there are three of them, and suddenly there are two of them.
Yeah.
And so you have to make someone disappear once you get them in the plane.
People disappear all through this play. So, you know, all of a sudden there's a crowd of people here, and then they're not there anymore. There are characters in this play who are triggered by different emotion who come up when that emotion comes up, and then they disappear. So this is a very non-linear piece that is told perhaps in dream time. It is extremely non-linear. You have the living intermixed with the dead inside of a place that the main characters are unsure where it is. And these other characters that come on keep changing where it is.
Do you think that if your budget is a little bit limited, it sounds as if it might almost be easier to accomplish some of this because you don't have to worry about moving too many sets around? Whereas if it was put on a bigger stage, suddenly it becomes a, how do you do this when you have the money to do it?
Our theater is perhaps the perfect size for it in that respect. Although I don't think people in theater who have lots of money to spend on it ever run out of ways to spend it. Whether they do it well or not is a different conversation.
Right.
So I think the challenge becomes when you're in a small house and you don't have a rotating stage or things that can fly away for you. Then how do you render something that takes the audience into the space you want them to be and make it a believable experience for them? Our set is a very abstract set, such as would befit a piece that's set in a place somewhere between worlds. And that set allows for us to reconfigure it as needed. And it happens right in front of the audience's eyes.
Ayodele and Zynga, going all the way back, you have an MFA and a PhD. Did you always want to be in the theater? What were your original ideas?
I have wanted to run away and join the theater, not the circus, the theater. Ever since I was about 6 years old, my introduction to theater was being in a play at my grandma's church. And I got to be the Christmas angel. I wanted to be Mary. And I had an attitude. I felt a way about not being the star. And so they told us to learn the script, to memorize the script. This was the first production I'd ever been in. I took them quite literally. I memorized the script.
Oh, the whole script?
The entire script. And when Mary was 2 seconds late with her line, I said it. And then when Joseph sort of looked like somebody had hit him in the face because I wasn't supposed to be saying Mary's lines, even if she forgot them, he froze with his line. So I said his line too. I was on a roll then. So I just did the play. My grandmother was delighted. The other parents, not so much so. I was hooked after that. My mother dissuaded me. She told me that it was not a reasonable profession for a Black girl. At that point in time, we hadn't had Julia Carroll or Oprah Winfrey. And it seemed like something she needed to protect me from. So she told me I should be a teacher. And it's odd because I think I honored her. I think that I do teach in a way. But like a lot of kids, I didn't listen to her. And so by not listening to her, I am literally living my dreams.
So where was that, and where'd you get the MFA and the PhD?
MFA from New College of California, while they were still real, and the PhD from California Institute of Integral Studies.
Are you a local person then from Oakland?
I live in West Oakland. I have lived in Oakland for over 50 years. About 50 years. I am acclimated to Oakland. I claim this is the space that I am from.
Where did you grow up then?
I grew up in Vallejo. My grandmother lived in Berkeley. I actually started out my California experience in Berkeley over on Woolsey Street with my grandma. I am from Stateline, Mississippi. I was actually born in Chicago, Illinois, and I have been in California ever since I was a very small child. I actually came into California into the Southern Pacific Railway in West Oakland.
After you got your degrees, at that point, were you thinking Hollywood? Were you thinking theater here? You have all of these degrees and you have all of this talent. I mean, I would think that Hollywood would be the first place you'd think, or New York.
It was a dream when I was younger. And it's funny how dreams work out. If you are really lucky, you end up exactly where you're supposed to be. I don't know if I'd run a venue if I were in New York or LA. I don't know if I'd have my own troupe. I don't know that I could afford to feed a troupe in LA or New York. And I don't know that that troupe would make the impact that I get to make with my troupe here. Even with Pac and Biggie, I had an experience over the weekend that reminds me why I do theater. Like I said, my mother told me this was not what I should do. I was dissuaded as a youth because, like most children who want to pursue arts as a career, you're told to have a backup. You need to do something else so you can eat, because you can't eat if you insist that you want to be a juggler. Well, that's not necessarily true. And so I like the idea of giving that opportunity and encouragement to people who are maybe meant to be something very, very different than what their parents might envision for them. Over the weekend, I gave the experience of seeing theater, full-length play, for the first time to about four young men. And through that, I discovered that one of my leads is in a play, but has never seen a play before. The number of people who have never seen a play is astounding to me. The only thing I like better than giving someone a first theater experience is signing the checks that pay my actors. Those things make me feel like a success. They make me feel something I think that's deeper, more enduring, and at the end, more important to my community than it would feel to be winning awards in New York or in Los Angeles. And I rack up a fair amount of awards right here, triangulating between three different fellowships in the moment. So I think I ended up where I was supposed to. It's really odd. I had this conversation with a young person this morning who I was explaining to them how extremely talented they were and telling them that if they wanted LA or New York, that they could have it. And explaining to them that you may not end up there because that has a lot to do with luck. It has nothing to do with talent. There are a lot of very talented people who we will never know their names because they won't be lucky enough to get exposure. So again, it makes me feel really important to be able to give people exposure. I'm really happy where I am.
I'm going to ask a question that I've asked many artistic directors in the past. What do you see as the importance of live theater as opposed to television, as opposed to film?
The immediacy. There's a line from a play, and I'm drawing a blank. I can't think of the name of it. And they talk about the immediacy of theater. And they say that in film, it's like Campbell's soup. They can shoot you over and over again and put you in a can after it's perfect. Now, I'm tipping into film, and I do some film. So I have a great appreciation for film as an art form. I have a great appreciation for television as an art form. I can't really imagine how they get some of the good work they get out of television with the way that it's often shot. That's some work for you. But the theater, they call it live theater because it's alive. As a performer, it's like a high wire act. We're humans, so we make mistakes. Can you recover so no one knows? Can you tell the story so well until people forget they're sitting in a backyard or sitting shoulder to shoulder in a theater? The feeling of when the lights come on, and my theater is a very intimate theater, and you look out at the audience and there are people crying. There is the closeness, the aliveness, the in-the-moment-ness. There's nothing like it.
I've talked to actors who say that even if it seems that they're on stage interacting with each other, they always know exactly what the audience is thinking and feeling at that moment.
I tell people, getting old is not for sissies, and acting is only for the super smart. You have to be able to leave your body. You have to be able to leave you behind. which actually means the way you think, the way you walk, the way you talk, the way you reason, that has no business on stage because you're not you on stage. You have to remember all of the lines. You have to remember exactly where your body is supposed to be. You have to give each moment like it's the first time. And if they bust out laughing, you have to have the consciousness to hold just long enough for them to get to the satisfying part of their laughter and then start it back up again before the timing on stage is ruined. It is like having every part of your body be uber alive at the same time. And there's this give and take between an audience and a performer that changes with different audiences. Some audiences are very vocal, or in a small theater, you can hear the, or the, did you see that? You can hear that in a small theater. And then there are spaces where something heavy or wonderful happens and it's dead silent. So being able to read the difference between it's dead silent because we just bombed that, or it is dead silent because they're all sitting there with their mouths open and you really nailed that.
I'm going to use genres, but this is in a very loose sense. Which is harder, directing comedy or drama?
Probably comedy. I actually don't know. I actually would defer and say they're probably equally hard. Comedy is very serious work. Comedy is a matter of perfect timing and nuance. I think that people naturally tend to overplay comedy. They don't understand that comedy is very subtle and very natural. It's only super, super funny. If I don't know, it's super funny. As the performer, and I allow the audience to discover the absurdities. So I think that people can go overboard on the comedy, and that disrespects the audience's intelligence. I think drama, though, is difficult sometimes because people have ideas about how to act. I'm an odd director in a sense. I tell cast early on, I'm not really interested in actors. I know that's how I got you here. That's what you call yourselves. But what I'm really interested in is human beings who know how to tell stories, who aren't afraid of assessing their own emotion, who remember how things feel, and then are willing to be naked on stage about those things. So I think that they both require a deft hand. My favorite form of theater actually is tragicomedy. I like things that are real. And life is a mixture of things that are funny and things that are very serious. And sometimes those very funny things and very serious things are happening in the same place at the same time.
I saw a production of Glass Menagerie at San Francisco Playhouse where the director made choices which completely changed the meaning of the play. And I understand the notion of creativity, wanting to add something to it. But it struck me that this just doesn't work. I see this a lot, and I'm just curious about your own opinions about such things.
Not a fan. Oddly, I say, I've had this discussion with Bika. I dislike living authors. I dislike them because they want to touch things. They're my toys now. Get away. You can't touch them anymore. You are a playwright. You've done your job. I'm a director. Let me do my job. And then I think that actors have a job, and I explain to them that their job is to please the director. However, there is also an obligation I have as a director to the playwright. You choose a piece of work because you believe in that piece of work. Small changes, it's good when they're dead, they can't complain. I saw a production by Cal Shakes of Wilson's Fences, and they turned it into a woman's play. It was an interesting play, and some very dear friends, some very talented colleagues were in that. It was just wrong. Wilson wrote from the male experience. It did not exclude women from being able to benefit from it, but to take that piece of work and then center it around female voice did to me a disrespect to the playwright himself. You can go pick up a pen, write your own play and say that, you know, this is reminiscent of the Glass Menagerie, or it's reminiscent of Fences by August Wilson. I don't ascribe to taking a piece of work by someone else and then attempting to make it mine by altering it.
It seems to me that you kind of nail that you do owe an obligation to the playwright to present the play that the playwright wrote. And if you don't like it, write your own play. One final question about Pock and Biggie Are Dead. When you're directing a piece that can go in so many ways, and if at some point you're trying to get information from Biko and Ease Goes, what do you think at that point? I would assume, how far are you willing to go, and are you necessarily going to want his permission to go there?
We had a long talk about the work before I undertook it. Like I said, I'm not necessarily a fan of living playwrights, but I've worked with a couple before, and I do have sympathy for how work is handled because I'm a playwright. So we talked about what our agreements look like, and we understand that he's a playwright, I'm a director, and a producer. So therefore, wearing two hats in this particular production, there's always a hierarchy in the room. You know, whether or not we respect or admit it. And the producer may trump both the writer and the director in this particular case. It has been a wonderful experience because it's a work that he has in development. I have allowed him more input than I normally would engage in with an author, because there are things he wants to learn about the work. There are things he is still finding out about what he's created. This is a very different production than he saw at Drexel, and it's a very different production. It's a full production, so it's very different than the workshopping he did in LA. There are boundaries, and so far we have been really, really good. I respect him as a playwright, so I want to tell the story that he wrote. He respects me as a director, so he keeps his fingers where they belong, and we're getting along fine.
Hi, Adele. And Zynga, what have you got coming up next? What is the next play, and when is the next play for Lower Bottom? And what else do you have on tap?
We'll be doing a reading of Baldwin's Amen Corner in September in celebration of Baldwin's centennial. Baldwin is an honorary artist in residence in BAM House for his centennial year. In November, we'll be doing an original piece written by me called Government Housing. It's a three-piece. They are three 45-minute pieces that can be presented over a weekend or all in one evening that deal with government housing. And they're based on my experience in living in subsidized housing and asking the question, what do we take from people when we give them subsidies? When we are in government spaces like the Army or colleges or foster care houses or subsidized housing, for all of those rules and procedures, are we giving people the best opportunity to become full humans? Are we further hobbling them in our assistance? So government housing. I have a short film coming out, Flowers for the Trash Man, which is another living author. Marvin X, who's the West Coast father of the Black Arts Movement, is the author of a classic play called Flowers for the Trash Man, based loosely on his youth. We've turned that into a film. I have an album coming out called Ghetto Grimoire that will be out in the next month or so. So that's a few things for you.
You've been listening to an interview with Ayodele Nzinga, who is the director of Pock and Biggie Are Dead by Biko Ayason Martin, which is at Lower Bottom Players, BAM House in Oakland through June 30th. And for more information, you can go to Lower Bottom Players. That's PLAYAZ.com. Until next time, I'm Rich Walensky. Radio Walensky usually posts every week on Sundays. You can write to me either at bookwaves@hotmail.com or richard@kpfa.org. You can find other Radio Walensky podcasts in the Area 941 section of kpfa.org, or you can go to bookwaves.homestead.com or richardwalensky.com for a complete listing of all digitized recordings. You can subscribe to Radio Walensky via iTunes or follow Richard Walensky Radio Shows on Facebook.